You found The Farcast, the weekly podcast in its sixth season of helping you understand what's going on in Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to The Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the 9th day of June. Here we are in June, folks, rolling into the end of the second quarter here for 2023. Stock market has been wonderful this year. In fact, we've had a wonderful year in the first 6 months. Almost 10% return or so from the S&P 500. That's not bad. And NASDAQ's gone up a lot more than that. The Dow hasn't done much at all. S&P equal weighted hasn't done much at all. Remember, folks, that the S&P 500 is a cap-weighted index. So the bigger you are, the more space you take up in the S&P 500. And there are very few companies that take up about 25%, like six or seven of them represent 25%. And then they get the other 493 companies that represent the other 75%. If you don't own the big six, seven, or eight, however you want to look at those stocks now that we used to call FANGs, you don't own them, you don't have performance. Diversified growth managers around the country are really taking gas. I chair a investment committee for a fund that is well over $1 billion. I've done it for years. I've gotten the report on all of our managers who have been with us for years, very good established managers. And boy, their numbers are right just down in the basement. They're up 1 or 2% maybe for the year across the board. Because they didn't take on the risk. One or two took on the risk and their numbers are up. And that, as a committee, has us wondering, gee, how much risk have those guys taken on? What are their concentrations? How are they doing it? And what's the message to Fred and Ethel at home about what you should be doing with your portfolio, how you should be thinking about this market with a Fed meeting coming up? This week, ladies and gentlemen, we've got Ken Polcari, of course, my great friend to start us out, Mahaffey coming up. We've got strategy coming as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Good morning, Ken Polcari from New York. How are you?
Hey, Michael, I'm great. How are you? I'm very excited now because we've just entered a new bull market, believe it or not. So, I'm
all good. Bull market. Isn't that wonderful? Tell me about the new bull market, Kenny.
It's really incredible, right? Yesterday, we saw the S&P continue to push higher. A lot of it powered by names that you just mentioned, right? The big tech names that are part of both the indexes, NASDAQ as well as the S&P. And they pushed us over that edge, right? So the S&P is now up 20% off the October, which puts it into a no bull market. So it's all very exciting, especially as the Fed meeting. They've done a very good job at kind of convincing us all that they're going to skip any movement next week. They're not going to hike. They're not going to pivot, then cut, but they're certainly not going to hike. And I think they're going to hold it steady. I think that's very clear. And that has helped kind of create the mood of excitement, I think, among stocks. But to your point, it is a handful of stocks that's really driving this move. And we know that at any moment, you get hit out of left field or you get something that's unexpected.
You know, Kenny, there's something here that's very striking in your comments, Kenny, something very striking in the Polcari commentary this morning. You've used the term exciting bull market about six times, and this is the least excited I've ever heard you, I think, in the 30 years we've known each other. You said every time you sound exciting, you say it, and then this is a really exciting bull market. I mean, if I were driving, I'd fall asleep at the wheel. I'd be off the road by now, Kenny.
I need another cup of coffee.
So you're using the word exciting, but you're not excited.
No, because it's a little bit cautious, right?
You've been very cautious.
I've been very cautious, but to your point, I own those names in the portfolio, right? So I have been participating in that sense. So it is exciting, but it's cautious because it just doesn't, it feels like Well, look at the VIX. It's very complacent. So it suggests to me that if we get hit with one thing out of left field that we're not expecting, you could see the market back off quickly and swiftly. And that's the part that kind of keeps me a little bit on. So, yes, am I excited about the S&P in a new bull market phase? Yes, but I'm not convinced that we're going to stay there at the moment. I'm just a little bit cautious as we go into the summer months.
We got a Fed meeting coming up next week. Why are you so cautious? You know, when you talk to some of the really bullish folks out there, Brian Pelsky, for instance, and you say, what, Brian, give me the upside. You're very bullish. Give me the upside for the year on the S&P. He goes, well, about 3 or 4% from here. Well, so Kenny, I mean, it's hard for me to get excited for 3 or 4% over the next 7 months. And if the S&P is trading at all-time highs or nearing all-time highs again, and we're up 20% since the fall, and it's buy low and sell high, should we be piling into this market? Why are people? I mean, I don't hear caution, I guess, from investors right now. Maybe you don't have to worry about it.
Well, so here's what I think you need to do, and I think you've started to see this over the last week or so. It feels like it's broadening out, right? We saw money move into banks. The regional banks have now been out positive on the year. You've got industrials. You've got money moving into healthcare, which just suggests the action is broadening out. It's not just going to be tech in those five or six names that we've been talking about. And that's what you have to see in order for it to be exciting, right? You've got to see much more participation amongst many more sectors versus just the tech. That's what you have to see happen. Now, if you don't see that happen, then I think that's where you have to then be worried that the market will pull off and pull back again, right? But look, even if we went up another 3% by the end of the year, that would take the S&P to up 11%. Add in divvies, all that, you're probably up to 13% on here, which, by the way, isn't so bad on a regular basis.
Isn't so bad. It's fabulous. I'd love it.
That's right. That's right. So in that sense, it is kind of exciting. But in the other sense, I don't think people should be so comfortable right now that they don't think there's a chance of a pullback or a chance that, we're going to hit a point where inflation remains sticky and doesn't come down anymore, which will force the Fed to start raising rates again. And I think that's what's kind of capping it out at the moment, right? The idea that, they'll skip in June, but there's always the possibility that they raise again in July and then again in September if inflation does not come down. And that's kind of going to be part of the wild card, at least
real,
in my mind.
Look, Kenny, real interest rates are still zero, meaning, ladies and gentlemen, the rate of inflation is equal to the Fed funds rate. So if you have money invested at 5% and inflation is eating away at that, eroding your purchasing power at a rate of 5%, you're not really making any money. See, you're not really making any money. But if zero is still the cost, essential cost of money, real rates are at 5%. Money's not, costing you that much at this point. So because your assets are increasing, you think at 5%, right? I mean, things are going up 5%, right, and you lose 5% of the others. So what do you do in that environment? Well, and Kenny, if it's 4,300 now and you say I've got 3 or 4% upside, Wall Street managers always say, but what's my downside? What's the downside from here?
Now, if I just look at it technically, it's going to be at the 41.50 level, which is where the 50-day moving average trend line is, which, by the way, is only 3% down, which is not a big move. But if you want my broader idea, I'm planning and I'm kind of setting myself up to see a pullback down to 3,900, 39, 3,850, 300, which would represent almost an 8% move, or, by the way, would considered well within the normal trading bands and the trading range of a market. So that's nothing to get completely concerned about. But I am preparing myself and building up a shopping list for stocks I want to buy or add to if that happens. I'm certainly not chasing tech up here. The index is up 24%, but individual names are up triple digits. But I will add to those names if we see a pullback that could potentially come if the Fed starts to hint at raises again, because they're just, inflation is just not responding quick enough.
You know what's dangerous, Kenny, is when portfolio managers get in that corner, get cornered, and they are way behind their benchmark, and they feel like they've got to do something to catch up. My friend Joe Albritton used to say, bad performance is like a bad haircut. You've got to give it some time. It will correct unless you try to fix it yourself, and then you're going to look like an idiot.
I also do think, to that point, that there are asset managers that were underpaid because they did expect us to be in a recession by now. They did expect growth was going to slow more than it has.
I think they waited.
Well, okay. So I think the excitement that we saw last week or last couple of weeks into tech, specifically AI, underweighted and said, I better get in. And that caused those names to surge, to your point, that in, asset managers were underweighted that sector and then decided to get in. So better they get in at least mid-year versus, you know, the last 2 months of the year.
So, okay, I'm with you on all of this. I think for me that this is one of those odd times where things are skewed kind of the wrong way. And we went through this in 2008. And when you got through June in 2008 during the second quarter, banks had rallied 20% because the Fed had solved that Bear Stearns problem on March 17th, 2008.
Right.
Oil had gone from 100 to 147 and a half from March 31st to June 24th. March 31st to June 24th, oil went from 100 to 147, 47.5% increase in the price of a global commodity. And if you didn't own oil, you look like a moron. And if you had pared back on the banks, you look like a moron. But then all of a sudden, by the end of the year, if you'd done both of those things, you were a top performing manager. So you look like a goat in June. You look like a god in December. Are we going to see another year like that, Kenny?
You know, I'm confused with what's going on with oil, quite honestly. I expected it to be higher specifically as we moved into the summer. But for some reason, it can't seem to get out of its own way. So it's a little bit confusing. We're entering summer. There's going to be high demand. I'm not buying into the story that global demand is being destroyed at all. Right. We get conflicting stories out of China. One day it's soft. One day it's strong. And so I'm not really sure I buy any of that. I'm still long oil. I like oil. I think energy is a place to be. And so we'll just have to see. But it does remain a conundrum for me, for sure.
I love it when you use those big words like conundrum. I love that. I love that, Pokari. I'm thinking, Kenny, to become aggressive when the market's making new highs is an amateurish mistake. So, folks, stick with your discipline. Know what you own. Stay the course and be careful. Be nimble. And know that there's a downside out there. And I think the downside is much bigger right now than the upside. Just this is 35, 36 years of experience doing this. I'm telling you, this doesn't feel right to me.
No, but that's why, to your point, know what you own and why you own it and new money that you want to put to work. Stick to that plan that I'm still sticking with is kind of the big, boring, beautiful names that are mega cap names outside of tech. So it's healthcare, it's consumer staples, names that are underperforming at the moment, right? Those sectors are underperforming at the moment. And so if the correction comes, you know as well as I do that the places like consumer staples, which are boring, utilities, which are boring, healthcare, which is boring, will find some shelter in the storm.
You know what Babe Ruth said, Kenny? Hit them where they ain't. What? Hit them where they ain't. And that's what you do as an investor. When everybody loves them, sell them. Exactly. When everybody hates them, buy them.
That's right. That's also a Warren Buffett model, right? Sell them when they're greedy and buy them when they're fearful.
Absolutely. All day long. Yeah. Americans love stocks when they're expensive and hate them when they're cheap. That's what Buffett says, too.
Right.
Kenny Pokari says it, Fred and Ethel. He's the CEO at Case Capital Advisors, the voice of the New York Stock Exchange for decades. And he's older than I am. Don't forget that. Kenny, you're the best. Have a wonderful weekend. We're going to come back with Dan Mahaffey. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Farcast. Now it's time for political analyst Dan Mahaffey and your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Kenny Pokari, talking about an exciting new bull market, and didn't sound excited at all. Talking to us from his hotel room in New York. Might have been a big night last night for Kenny. Could have been a big night, dampening the enthusiasm and normal tenor of his voice. But could be the markets too. So listen to Pokari here. He's not enthusiastic for any number of reasons, perhaps. Dan Mahaffey, of course, is always enthusiastic. if not about Washington, then just certainly life in general, as director of policy for the Center of the Study of the Presidency and Congress, a Washington, D.C. think tank. And above all, he is the senior political analyst for the Farcast. Hey, Mahaffey, welcome back, buddy.
Thanks. Good to be talking to you, Michael. How are you today?
I'm doing better than Donald Trump this morning, I think.
I think we all are.
All of the legal involvement that President Trump has endured throughout his career and the way he brushes it off and acts like it's nothing and we'll just sue you. And I can't remember how many lawsuits President Trump and his organization are typically involved with, but it's usually multiple at any one time. A federal indictment is different, isn't it, Dan?
President Trump, I will say, is a very adept person. I would say almost, I'll go ahead and I'll use the term a hacker, who understands how to use the political and legal system to his advantage. And okay. He's done that for decades in his real estate dealings, his business dealings, everything that he has been able to do. And this, though, is an entirely different ballgame when you start dealing with federal prosecutors, classified documents, and the Espionage Act. These are not, some things that you can kind of trivialize or play. We've talked about this with Jim Labenthal. The secrets are considered by many the holies of the holy. These are national secrets. And they're not just something that you take with you when you leave office as a souvenir.
Dan, there's going to be a lot of folks out there in his base who say, this is those Democrats. This is Joe Biden's attorney general. This is Joe Biden's Justice Department. Can't lose to Donald Trump again. Going to win and have to beat him again. And they're going after him unfairly. And this is a big nothing. And they're now taking this thing too far. And it's going to get really angry.
Right. And that's going to be how the Republican base responds to this, particularly the Trump MAGA base. He's playing up the persecution narrative. It's the dueling narratives we have of if you are in MAGA world or in the rest of the country, frankly, on how this is perceived. But you do have that sense of, look, he's being besieged by the Biden administration, the Justice Department. That narrative is there. And I actually find it going to be hardest for these Republican candidates who are also trying to run against him. Obviously, I think it's fine for Chris Christie, who I'm not sure if he's running for president of the United States or chief prosecutor of the Trump family. But for the other ones, you saw, Mike Pence there saying, President Trump violates the Constitution, but the Justice Department should investigate him. How they get that through this Republican primary is the stranger thing, but I'll leave the legal experts to handle the jail time, how long that's going to take, all those kinds of things that could happen in the trial. But politically, this is just, again, it's this phenomenon. It reinforces Trump's support in his base, but then reminds the rest of American voters on why they don't want this show again.
They don't want this show again. Does that have enough traction so that Donald Trump doesn't get that nomination for the Republican Party, or does he still get the nomination, Dan?
Well, he gets the nomination if you still have this Donald Trump versus a cast of 10 or 20 where there's no clear runner against him. Now, obviously, DeSantis has been the first and foremost of that, and he's trying to regain momentum. But the structure right now as it is still favors Donald Trump in both the way the primaries work as well as the ardor of his supporters.
Okay, so how does this play out? I mean, the president has to appear in a
Miami federal court on Tuesday afternoon. We know it's the Southern Florida venue, so you're not going to have that question of, is it a liberal D.C. jury type question being raised? But I also worry about what kind of kooks and crazies this brings out as we move forward with this. We all look back on history on when Ford pardoned Nixon. And we know part of that was an idea of trying to tie the nation's wounds together in a way. But it was also realistically so Ford could have a political agenda and not be simply going through more and more Nixon scandals. This is going to take a lot of the air out of what will be 2024 coverage going ahead. It's going to make it harder for DeSantis and others to get the airtime they need unless they're willing to go ahead and directly attack Trump again, like you've seen with Christie or Asa Hutchinson or some of those.
Got it. Kevin McCarthy got sucker punched a bit this past week. No votes out of nowhere.
Sudden recess. Yeah, look, we've had now the tensions have been building among the GOP caucus, among GOP leadership themselves. If you look at the interviews and discussions between McCarthy and Scalise as well, but you had this rebellion by the conservatives. They stopped the you know, sort of inside baseball. They stopped the rule moving forward. It's a very unusual rebellion, but it basically is frozen house business. And it shows you too that even after we've gotten past this debt ceiling debate, the issues at hand, a gun control measure as well as a abortion restriction, conservatives liked that. They are angry with McCarthy. Moderates are angry about things that bring up abortion and guns moving into the election. This is frozen. They're going to have to figure out a way through it. One member of Congress best described it to me as sort of the sense, though, that everyone's been in too long of a road trip together, and maybe it's a time for a little bit of a rest, get out the car, let tempers calm a bit. But McCarthy does have this rebellion.
Hang on. I like that. We've been in the car too long together. We need to get out and walk around for a while before we kill each other.
Yeah, something like that. Everyone who's been on a family road trip knows that moment of just need some fresh air.
Yeah,
I had
three sisters, and somewhere mom and dad drove us down to Disney in 1976, I think it was. And my three sisters are younger than I, and there were three in the front and three in the back. And we drove from D.C. To Orlando, spent the night halfway down in some motel somewhere, and that was a long trip in the family. That's a long trip. There were a couple of times we all got out of the car. Yeah,
exactly. So that's the issue they face. Look, I think in the longer run, we look at the to-do list that remains for the rest of this year, particularly in September. So they'll go away for the summer. Let's take that long walk. But end of September, we need to get the FAA reauthorized. We need our farm bill. We need the Coast Guard reauthorization for their programs. The pandemic preparedness is due. And then let's not forget that the deal that we had for the debt ceiling requires all the budgeting to get done by the end of September on time, 12 budget bills. Otherwise, you have that 1% penalty on the spending caps if they don't do it on time. This all has to be done by September 30th. And you have a Congress, at least a House right now, that's not working. The message might be, though, what we learned from the debt ceiling, and perhaps these conservatives have overplayed their hand, is that you're not going to get the more controversial conservative priorities through, but you'll find ways to get a bipartisan coalition to keep the government running, to keep these programs, like, again, the Coast Guard. We don't argue about the Coast Guard. We don't argue about, well, we might argue about vaccines, but we don't argue about pandemic preparedness. FAA...
You don't sound overly concerned at this point. You're making me feel like this is just more of the Washington nonsense, and we'll see if it's serious in the fall when they have to actually pass.
Correct. Yeah.
Have I got that right?
Correct. Right now, like, for example, the most heated thing I hear about the FAA is, do we get more long-range flights out of National Airport?
Yeah, I got it. That's stuff I can live with. Okay, let's, that's not debt ceiling. That's not debt ceiling crucial. So let me move on to one final thing just quickly here, Dan. Don't have much time left. President Biden vetoed that bill that was going to vacate his pause on the student loan repayments. We got this battle in Washington. What's going on about this student loan thing? And what does it mean for the president to step in and veto that?
Well, look, when the president vetoes a bill, you see it rarely, but we just know that means, you know, it can be overridden by 2/3 of each House of Congress. I don't think we're going to see that happen on the student loan matter. I also think a lot of this is politics, because the what really matters on the student loan question is the Supreme Court ruling. Obviously, that's regarding the vacation of payments or forgiveness. That you also have, though, the separate repayment issue and when those payments start up again, which is tied up in the pandemic emergency, which is going to lapse anyway.
Is this a big deal or not? So you're telling me that this student loan thing's coming down to the Supreme Court and really
it's coming down to the Supreme Court. The thing is, where it's political is it's in messaging. For the Democrats, this is big to, you know, get out the base. And for Republicans, it's another, you know, look at Biden handing out things to young people.
Got it. Dan Mahaffey is the director of policy at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, the senior political analyst on the Farcast, now in season six. You know, in a couple of months, we're going to season seven here. I can't believe it, Dan the man, but you have been invaluable. And we hear from listeners all the time how much they learn from listening to our man Mahaffey. So thank you, Dan, very much. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
When we come back, Dr. Jay Bryson, chief economist for Wells Fargo, he's going to tell us what the Fed's thinking now, what's happening with interest rates. Is Jeff Lacker right that the Fed funds have to go to 6.5%? We're going to see what Bryson says when we come back on the Farcast.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. We appreciate you listening into the Farcast this week. And now to introduce this week's special guest, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. Michael Farr here. As always, it is the ninth day of June. We have a Federal Reserve meeting next week, and the message is pause. Pause. They're not going to do anything at this meeting is the big message. It could change, but we'll see. Probably going to pause. And then the idea is they'll raise at the July meeting and this drumbeat continues. Dr. Jay Bryson is the chief economist at Wells Fargo, is my great friend for many years, one of the smartest guys I talk to. But folks, you can have really smart friends who really can't speak English. And they are fun to have around, but a bit mystifying and particularly useful if you want to feel really stupid. And Bryson, on the other hand, speaks English, and he can make even folks as challenged as I am intellectually feel like we understand stuff. So if he can make me understand, I hope it's helpful to you, and it should be very easy for y'all. Hey, Jay, welcome back to the Farcast.
Guten Morgen, Michael.
Guten Morgen, pal.
V. Gates.
Jeff Lacker was on last week or week before, and Lacker says real rates are zero because inflation is 5%. Rates are at 5%. Real rates are where they were before all of this stuff started. We've got to go to 6.5% minimum on rates. Farr said, wait a minute. Inflation a year ago was 9.something%. It's now 5%. Give it a couple of months, it might be 4%, and then real rates will be at 1%. The Fed doesn't have to do anything. And he said, no, that's not right. Well, I mean, it would be right, but that's not going to happen. I said, okay. I don't know why. What do you think, Jay? I'm not the economist.
Well, Michael, actually, I kind of agree with you a little bit more here than I do with Dr. Lacker on this one. I mean, he's right. If you're looking at the overall CPI rate of inflation right now, it's a roughly 5%. The nominal Fed funds rate is roughly 5%. So that gives you zero. However, the CPI inflation rate's coming down. Our expectation is that the next CPI print, it'll probably be on a year-over-year basis. It's going to be closer to 4% than 5. Yeah.
Really?
And so now, you know, the core
rate. That's our headline, Harry, CPI 4%.
You know, part of that is just it's a decline in gasoline prices. You know, if you look at the overall core rate of inflation, it's going to be a little bit higher than that. But the point is that inflation is coming down. Monetary policy works with a lag. And I would think that, you know, a few months from now, you're going to be looking at a real Fed funds rate of roughly, you know, 1%. So that's the nominal Fed funds rate minus the inflation rate. And if you go back and you look at 2000, you know, the last expansion before the pandemic in 2018-19, we were at a real Fed funds rate of 1%. And that was putting some extraordinary downward pressure on the rate of growth in this country. So I think, you know, if you go to 6% at this point, the Fed's going to over tighten, and then you're looking at a recession for sure.
So, you know, I asked the other thing I asked Lacker was why haven't we had a recession yet? Why? I mean, everybody, I thought we would be in recession now. I thought we and who knows, maybe we will be by the time it's about also a backward looking, you know, kind of a judgment call by a neighbor. But maybe, but it doesn't feel like it, frankly. So I just thought we would be by now, given everything else we were seeing. And so I said, Lacker, why haven't we seen this? And he goes, because the Fed hadn't raised rates enough. They haven't stopped it enough. And I go back to that issue of maybe they just haven't given it enough time because they've done so much so quickly. And if you and I perhaps are right about this, and I'm thrilled, ladies and gentlemen, you know, when Jay Bryson agrees with me on something economic, I am doing my happy dance around my office. You can't imagine how good that feels, folks, that Jay Bryson agrees with me on something economic, only because I make it up and he actually knows what he's talking about. So if that happens, Jay, then that puts us in this possibility of a soft landing. Your Wells Fargo's not calling for that yet. You're still calling for mild recession. Could we do soft landing?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, so in terms of the recession thing, the first part, you know, why aren't we in recession right now? I would argue there are sectors that probably are in a little bit of recession right now. Manufacturing at best has stalled. It's declining. Housing, maybe that's stabilizing, but housing is down 15%, at least in terms of housing starts. So you have recessions there. You just haven't seen it in the service sector yet. You haven't seen it in consumer spending because consumer balance sheets at this point are still very, very healthy. And you know, consumers haven't felt a lot of stress at this point. So, you know, could you get a soft landing at this point? The answer is yes, but what you have to do is you have to get some, I'll use a euphemism, some slack in the labor market, okay? And what that means in real terms is you have to have the unemployment rate come up a little bit. You have to have wage pressures moderate to bring inflation back down to 2%. So what the Fed has to do is it has to have the unemployment rate come up a little bit without generating an inflation without generating a recession. And that's a really tricky thing to do if all you have is the blunt instruments of interest rates that work with long and variable lags.
It doesn't sound like at this point you feel like the Fed has grossly misstepped at this point.
I don't know. I don't think that they have grossly misstepped at this point. Now, if, you know, they fully charge ahead and, you know, a few months from now, we're looking at a Fed funds rate at 6%, then I think they have grossly overstepped at this point. And I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think you can have, now, if Mr. Lacker was still sitting, you know, on the FOMC, he would be voting to raise rates at this point.
Yes.
But I think that the median there or the critical mass of members aren't at that point. And so I think they are feeling their way in to where they need to be. And, you know, it goes back to what you started with. I think they're going to be on pause at the next FOMC meeting.
Will they raise in July? I mean, that's what they're whispering about.
Yeah, you know, gun to my head right now, knowing what I know right now at this moment, I would say, yes, they probably will raise in July. But markets
can change, right? Between
a lot can change, right? You know, they're not on a predetermined course at this point. They're right. They'll look at the incoming data, particularly in terms of payrolls and particularly in terms of inflation, and they'll make their mind up as they go along.
So two things here, because Dan Mahaffey had a question earlier about the huge issuance of bills that's coming out. You know, over $1 trillion coming to market. Government has to raise a lot of money. Historically, these are high numbers. Is this an issue? Do you all pay attention to that sort of thing?
You know, I think it's a short-term sort of issue. I mean, it's not a surprise to the market in theory. Right. In theory, it should be priced in at this point. You know, it should have could have caused some short-run distortions if some of the auctions don't go well, yes. But I don't think it's a, you know, I don't think rates are going to be significantly higher 3 or 4 months from now just because of all the issuance that's coming up.
You know, to say that I have a simplistic understanding of economics doesn't do justice to the word simplistic, but one of the ways I look at economics, at least U.S. economics, and my understanding of the U.S. economy is when 70% or 65 or 70% of it depends on the consumer, you better pay damn close attention to the consumer. And you've described a consumer that's living on yesterday's laurels, yesterday's cash balances, and that it sounds like, you know, I picture one of those crash safety tests where you look at the room where the car is charging to the wall and it's going to hit the wall. I mean, there's no way it's not going to hit the wall. Is the consumer going to hit this wall? Are we watching a slow roll car wreck here, Jay?
You know, so Michael, I would say this is not, so if you and I were having this conversation in 2006 or seven, I would say,
and we may have,
we may have, right. I would say hitting the wall, it's inevitable, or, you know, just the way consumers were all levered up back then. Consumers are not levered up right now. And so their excess cash savings that's left over from the stimulus checks that they got are slowly coming back down. But keep in mind that the employment growth remains very strong right now. That's putting income into people's pockets. And so, you know, again, I think that consumer spending will contract in coming months, but I wouldn't say, you know, it's a quote, hit the wall, Katie bar the door. We're looking for a major retrenchment in consumer spending because in general, the financial position of the household sector is pretty good right now.
What's the catalyst then to see this unemployment rate go up? I mean, certainly, you know, what the textbook says, sort of at the end of a cycle, you see a growth, a resurgence in the workforce because people who have not counted themselves as unemployed suddenly come back and start looking for work, ladies and gentlemen. And you see actually the unemployment rates start to tick up only because things are actually getting better. Is that what's happening now? Because that isn't going to alleviate that wage pressure that you and I and the Fed are concerned about. What alleviates, what really chink, how do we get a chink in unemployment with this many people, you know, not few people unemployed and that many job openings?
Well, the way you really have to do it is you have to slow the demand for workers. And that comes about through higher interest rates. I mean, what we have seen over the last, I'll call it almost year or so, we have seen the supply of labor pick back up. The labor force participation rate has been trending a little bit higher. People are coming back. But in order to really get the unemployment rate to move up, you have to do it on the demand side. You have to slow the demand for workers. And that comes about through higher interest rates. And, you know, so far, we really haven't seen that. Employment growth has remained very, very strong, particularly in the service sector. It's slowed down in the manufacturing sector. It has slowed down in construction, but we just haven't seen it yet in the service sector.
Two final questions, and I have less than 30 seconds. In general, how do you feel about the economy over the next 12 months? And folks think that the Fed will begin to ease somewhere in the first half of 2024, which means things will really be crimped in the first half of 2024. Do you agree with that? And how do you feel about the economy over the next 12 months? And we got to go.
So in general, I think the economy is doing pretty well right now. Again, I don't think it's, you know, if we have a recession, I don't think it's going to be, you know, a major sort of downturn or anything like that. I do believe the Fed will be cutting rates next year because of partially because of that recession. But again, in general, I feel pretty good about the economic outlook because there aren't huge imbalances in the economy right now.
Dr. Jay Bryson is the chief economist for Wells Fargo. We are so happy to have you with us. One of the smartest guys, as you've just heard once again on the Farcast, a fan favorite. Jay, thank you so much.
Michael, always a pleasure.
And Jay's son just got his PhD in economics, ladies and gentlemen. There's something genetic here. So let me tell you something. That's going to be contributions to the rest of our country. Jay has made great contributions at the Federal Reserve and at Wells Fargo throughout his career. We are better off for his insights, and his son is going to, young Mr. Bryson, Dr. Bryson, is going to continue the family tradition. I'm really proud of him. I know you are, Jay.
I certainly am. Thanks, Michael.
Congratulations. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. We'll be back next week. Give you the best insights our experts can share. Please share us on your social media, and thank you so much for listening. From Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, and for Harry Jennings, our producer, I'm Michael Farr. Have a wonderful weekend. Bye.
That's a wrap for this week's episode of the Farcast. Thanks to this week's guest, Kenny Pulcari, Dan Mahaffey, and chief economist from Wells Fargo, Dr. Jay Bryson. And thanks to you, our listeners. We hope you enjoy the show as much as we enjoy making it for you every week. The Farcast comes to you weekly and is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. We love hearing from you every week, and you can reach us at hjennings@farrmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have and topics you'd like to hear us cover. We'd like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. The information, statements, comments, views, and opinions expressed and provided in the podcast, including by speakers who are not officers, employees, or agents of Hightower Advisors or Farr Miller in Washington, are not necessarily those of Farr Miller in Washington, Hightower Advisors, or any firm any of our guests may represent. Any mention of a specific security should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any security, index, fund, manager, or strategy. We strongly recommend you review with a financial professional before you make any investment decision. And if we can be of assistance at Farr Miller in Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'll be happy to put any of our listeners in touch with one of our investment professionals for a complimentary review of your portfolio and your investment goals. Take care, stay safe, stay healthy. We'll be back with you next week. Go beyond the headlines each week with the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farr Miller in Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties, expressed or implied, as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates assume no liability or any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice.
Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.